Hi guys, just a reminder that this podcast, as well as many of my online resources, is delivered freely. If you would like to help me get this message of healing out to millions of people around the world, please consider clicking on the donate button on my website, thecureforchronicpain.com. Thank you. Hello, everybody. How are you today? This is Nicole, and you have reached my podcast, The Cure for Chronic Pain, with me, Nicole Sachs. Welcome to it. Welcome to almost a new year. If you are listening when the podcast drops, it will be dropping on New Year's Eve day. The day that we are all preparing to welcome in the new year. I myself am not a New Year partier type girl, kind of never was, even back in the day when I used to party. I'm just kind of one of those people that thinks New Year's is just maybe a little overblown. No offense to anyone who freaking loves it, but I will most likely be asleep by 10, but with total peace about it. But either way, I do love the concept of a new year, and I love the concept of the ability to give ourselves a reason to start fresh. I actually think that every morning when I wake up, you know, every morning is a possibility of wiping the slate clean and saying, how do I really want to make some changes today? And I've been making some real concrete changes in my life. I'm not going to talk about them today because today is an interview and I don't want to take too long with the intro, but I will come back to it in a solo pod about what it means to make real substantive change in our lives and how long it takes and what it means and what that stairway looks like. So stay tuned for that. But yes, it's a new year, and just a reminder that if indeed you do need a new start, there's so many ways I can help you. Go to my website, thecureforchronicpain.com, click on the resources tab, click on the retreats tab, listen to one of my retreat recordings. They're all on specific topics that you might be really needing help on. Come and study with me and my guest instructors at an in-person or a virtual retreat. There are so many ways to really take the reins of your life. This is your life. It is yours. Just never forget that. You have the power to change course anytime you choose. And even though it feels like the choice is nearly impossible sometimes, there is always that still small voice within you that says, go, go, go. You can do this. And I'm here to echo that voice. So check that stuff out. And also remember that a partner of mine and a huge help in this chronic pain journey, whether your pain is emotional, physical, anxiety, a lack of joy for life, is the Curable app. The Curable app is helping millions of people around the world at this point, I'm sure, with their chronic pain journey. And because it's an app, you can access it anytime, anywhere, with a wealth, a bottomless pit of information. And right now they're running a new promotion, which they've never done before, which I think is an incredible opportunity. When you sign up for Curable, you get 14 days completely free of the full app, no restrictions. So you can check out the brain science, you can check out the writing exercises, you can check out the guided meditations, you can check out the expert talks from doctors and people like me who are doing this work with, you know, thousands and thousands of people around the world. So it's really great, and you can try it for 14 days with literally no obligation. So if that's something that interests you, go to www.getcurable.com/Nicole. And you will be able to take advantage of that incredible deal. So definitely do that for yourself as part of your New Year's toolkit, because it's there for you. All right, so that is it for me. I want to introduce this real-time heal. It's been a long time since I've done a real-time heal. And this is Shannon. I absolutely loved this interview with my whole heart. Shannon is such a lovely person and has really been through it. And so often our journeys feel particularly painful because we just are so confused during so much of it. And I know at the early stages of this, Shannon really was confused as to why she was the way she was, born really sensitive, born with a lot of different big feelings, and the way it moved through her body, whether it be panic disorder or phobias or an eating disorder, you know, all different unexplained situations that made her feel really scared and confused. And she was able to move through it with the help of this work. And she's doing great. And it's a real-time heal. So she's a work in progress, just like we all are. And it's wonderful to walk people through these real-time heals, to hold their hand as they experience their trepidation and their hesitancy, and then to watch them really gain strength from the conversation. So it's wonderful for me. So I'm excited to share it with you. So, you know, good luck in the new year. We all just need to have as much as possible a hopeful attitude, because I choose hope. I really do. I choose hope. I choose to replace my fear with curiosity. I wonder what this year will bring. I wonder what bright pinpricks of light I will see through things that have been challenging. And I invite you to wonder too, because the magic is in the unknown and the magic's in the possibilities. And I really think that's the best we can hope for. So I hope that for you. Happy New Year. I send you big, big love, and enjoy this interview, this real-time heal I did with Shannon. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the pod. Today, I have a real-time heal with Shannon. Welcome, Shannon.
Hi. Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here. And I know Shannon said it to me before we got on air. This is the first time she's ever done this, which is pretty much the situation for anyone who I ever talk to. So you're in very good company. And she said she's a little nervous, but I'm going to share her nervousness. I'm going to like absorb half of it into me. So Shannon, you're good.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, honey. So start wherever you want to start. As always with these real-time heals, I have no idea where it's going to go, but wherever it goes, it'll be where it's meant to go. So kind of start from wherever you're comfortable and tell us about how you came to contact me.
Okay. Well, when I was 10, I started having panic attacks, and I was a sensitive, kind of anxious child, and so I think I was heading towards that anyways. But it was after I had been really, really sick. I started one day in school, I just out of nowhere, I had a panic attack where I suddenly felt really nauseous, and I had had like a stomach virus a few weeks before. And all of a sudden, I was terrified, and I realized that I was terrified of throwing up. And I ran to the bathroom, and I thought I was going to be sick. And then I went into the office, and I told the teachers in the office that I was sick. And it was in the winter, and so they were like, okay, you know, we'll call your parents and you can go home, because they just assumed, yeah, she knows what she's talking about. But as soon as my mom pulled up in the car, I felt 100% fine. And
yeah, that's how it goes with anxiety.
But I had no idea what it was at the time, and my parents didn't either. So this kept happening for the rest of the year, and I was able to verbalize, you know, I was like, I don't know why, but I always get better as soon as you're here. And so then it started to be that my mom would just talk to me on the phone and try to like calm me down. And it didn't really get any better. And so a couple of years later, my mom went to see an EMDR therapist, and she took me too. And we went there for a week and saw her every day. Cause my mom had claustrophobia. And I got a little better.
How old were you when you did this?
12.
Wow. That's like pretty advanced to take your kid for EMDR when they're 12.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that my mom had heard that it was good for getting rid of phobias, and so she thought, well, by then she was like, you know, it seems like you have a phobia. So it seemed to help. And then maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, this is all connected. I developed an eating disorder. It seemed to kind of spontaneously come from me being just very insecure and shy and just having low self-esteem. And that eating disorder, especially when I look back now, just kind of covered over my phobia. It became front and center, and my phobia was like, oh, that's just not that important anymore. And then this is kind of embarrassing, but it's all part of the story, because I see this, I see how these things are just being replaced. I was eating so little and also drinking so little, because I was like 13, 14, like I didn't know what I was doing. And I got like really, like I didn't go to the bathroom for like a week. And that was very traumatic. That's all I'm going to say there. And so then.
Well, you don't have to be embarrassed, because I had chronic constipation as a kid, and my mom used to have to give me enemas. It was horrible. And it was all TMS, yeah. And I didn't know it. So don't be embarrassed.
Okay. Well, that's exactly what happened to me. And I was so traumatized by that, that then all of a sudden, after that, my eating disorder completely went away. And the only thing I cared about was like never being constipated again. And I became obsessed. And my mom was concerned that I was drinking too much water, and she would like find me like hiding in the pantry, just like guzzling bottles of water.
Oh,
and she was,
honey,
like,
you were trying so hard to keep yourself safe.
Yeah. And I would like choke down these like fiber tablets, and like I couldn't, I just like, I couldn't sleep if I wasn't drinking like laxatives every day. And it was a thing for years. And then at my senior year, well, around that same time, I was discovering my sexuality, and I realized that I was gay. And I had grown up, you know, in a church, like in a medium-sized town, and like my mom was pretty religious, and I had gotten a lot of messages growing up that like there was only one way to be married, and there was only one way to like truly love, and everything else was just an abomination. Like I had gotten a lot of those messages, and I was also a very, very sheltered child. So,
was it just you and your mom in the house?
No, my dad, and then I had a younger sister too.
Okay. So you kept saying your mom. So I just was curious. So you did have a father and a sister, and was their energy like sort of less impactful that you didn't think to mention them?
I guess. I have an interesting relationship with my sister. I was always, this is terrible, but like I'm 4 years older than her, and I remember when I was born, I was kind of resentful of her taking up my parents' time and energy. And my parents were kind of like, you know, what's wrong with you? Aren't you an excited big sister? And I was like, no, I'm not at all.
That's totally normal, by the way. You shouldn't be embarrassed. My daughter, when my son was born, it was like the worst for her. So I get it.
Okay. And then my dad, I have a wonderful relationship with him now, and with both of my parents. And I have a decent relationship with my sister now, but when I was younger, my dad had a lot of anger issues, and I think it was stuff from his own childhood. And so whenever my sister and I would fight, he would get really angry with me and say, you know, as the older sister, I should be doing better. And sometimes my sister and I, you know, would hit each other and like call each other names. I think that's pretty normal. But my dad would get really angry with me and say, you know, don't you dare like touch your sister. And like, and there, I definitely have some, I think I have some trauma still from that, even though we have a good relationship now. And, but that might be why. I mean, I've definitely been closest to my mom.
And I also think that the trauma has very little to do with what kind of nice relationship that you have now, and everything to do with the shame and the core wound that happens when we're told over and over again as young children that we're the problem, which is we start to internalize that we're bad. And I'm not blaming this on your father. You know, like if you ever hear me talk about parenting, especially being a parent myself, there's no such thing as a perfect parent, and we're always just trying to manage our own issues and then like what seems really inconvenient about children's misbehavior. So there's no one at fault here, but just to really understand that like that's very, very normal and also very understandable that you would have a lot of difficult feelings because you were being told all the time that it was your fault. Like you should stop. You're the oldest. You should stop. And whether or not that's true, the messages we receive when we're kids resonate throughout our lives.
Yeah. And growing up, I saw my sister just having an easier time of life than me, especially when we were both school aged. Like once she got to elementary school and I was transitioning into middle school, I saw her just academics came so much easier to her and social life came so much easier to her. She was more like quote unquote popular. She had more friends. She was less afraid of everything. Like she could just go on the school overnights, you know, no big deal. And I always asked to, you know, to stay home. So I think I was like, well, from the perspective of me as a child, I was like, you know, it's not fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
so you've got a lot going on at one time. You are having this crazy pinball machine of symptom imperatives that you have absolutely no idea all come from the same place, which is a place of fear and anxiety, which started out as this fear of vomiting and the sickness and this anxiety. And then it moved to this eating disorder. And then it moved to this absolute panic of constipation. I relate tremendously to everything you're saying because I have my own story around all those things. And it's really hard as a kid. And it's like also so sort of beautiful and obvious the way one continued to take the place of the other. And at the same time, you're an adolescent, which just sucks as it is, and having to figure ourselves out. And then you're realizing that you're gay and you're living within this family where there's some level of religious expectations and the messages you received, which is this is how to be good. And you've already been told a little bit that you're bad because you're the one who fights with your sister. So I can see that this is a lot for a sweet little thing to be trying to assimilate. And I know there was some other really big thing. Something happened with your house, right? You wrote it in your email.
Yeah. So that was just in April. I was just kind of setting up because I know, you know, I heard on one of your other podcasts, like there's just something like just someone watching their TMS jump from one thing. And I just put it together just recently about how it was like it kept going back and forth between something else and then an eating disorder, and like And so then, like, later in high school, my eating disorder got a lot worse, to the point in college where I was like, it was really bad. So fast forward to this, this April, I was home for spring break. I'm a teacher, in another state, but I still come home for all my breaks because, like, my family is still my family. You know, I don't have my own family yet.
How old are you, Shannon?
31.
Okay.
I would love to meet my soulmate. I was convinced that I was going to, like, have, you know, met my soulmate by now. But I'm pretty sure when I was 14, I was like, this is the year I'm going to meet my Princess Charming. And, like, it's been, you know, 17 years. So no, it's not happening. But, I was home for spring break and just having a really lovely time. And midweek, my mom and I were having lunch, and she said, we just got an email that, and I don't want to name names because it's a little bit tenuous because it's somewhere where she works. So I'm going to say where we live. There's a university that bought the land that our neighborhood sits on. And they said that they were going to build a new university building there, and that we had a year and a half to pack up and move, and then they were demolishing the entire neighborhood.
Wow. That's really, really difficult.
And I mean, I don't think there's any way for me to fully describe how impactful and terrifying that was for me, other than to maybe say, I love home so much, and I get so homesick, that in college, I went to college for like 4 years, and I did not spend a single weekend, in college. I came home every single weekend because I wanted to be at home every last little second that I possibly could. And everything in my life since college has been about, let me just get through this thing so that I can get back home. And even taking this job, a few states away from where I live and grew up, it's always been, I'm just going to muscle through this semester so that I can have the reward of being home for the holidays. I'm just going to muscle through these months so that I can have the joy of being home for a week during spring break. I'm just going to muscle through this year so that I can spend the summer at home, which is where I truly want to be. So, I mean, if that is any way to impart the significance of being told that my safe place that brings me the most joy of anywhere in the world, is being taken yeah. away from me. That's, you know, and to make, you know, to make it worse, it's, you know, it's 100-plus-year-old little arts and crafts house, as are the other houses around there.
Oh,
and my dad is an artist and architect, and over the course of my life, he has meticulously renovated each room of the house and restored it to more of the way it was, you know, when it was first built. And when I was a teenager, I got to help him redesign my bedroom, and it just, every single room is beyond meaningful, even just the meaning of growing up there.
So this is not a house. This is like a death. This is like a
yes.
death. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And it's more than a death. It's a murder.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And the whole time, it's funny because my mom is like, it's not like you're losing one of us. It's not like you're losing a loved one. And I'm like, inside, I'm like secretly, I'm like guilty. I'm like, I know that, but I feel like I am actually. I feel like I'm losing a third parent.
Yeah, I can feel that. I mean, as you were saying it, that's what I felt like. I felt like it was a death. And then the word murder came up because it's not like it's a natural death. It's being forced. It's being killed. It's being demolished against your will.
Yeah. Yeah. And my dad emailed them back and said, and kind of wrote like just a really beautiful and long email talking about, because it's very painful for my parents as well. It's a house they bought together after they got married. And, you know, they've raised their children there. And my dad told the whole story of that and kind of asked, like, is there anything we could possibly do? And their reply was basically, no. And by the way, if you refuse, just keep in mind that we are claiming power of eminent domain because it's a government university. So they can technically say that they're using it for public use.
And so I'm just curious, just to understand this more deeply, do your parents own this house?
Yeah.
So how does that work? You just don't, you own it, but you don't?
Well, the university is supposed to pay us for the price of the house, you know, as if we were to, you know, put it on the market and sell it. But my parents are concerned because of other things that the university has done in the past to other buildings, other neighborhoods, and other people. They're concerned that they're not going to do it fairly. So I wanted to make a documentary about this. And they said, you can make it for yourself, but don't put it out anywhere.
Your parents said this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm gathering the information that I need. So essentially, your safety that was established very young. I mean, you were born into this house, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you having this panic attack at school, thinking you were going to be sick and being picked up by your mother, coming home to this place. You know, the thing with meaning attachment as children is that we don't attach meaning to something like this is my house. We attach meaning to something like this is a feeling, which is why kids are so deeply affected by bullying. Like even if the bully ends up to be a complete loser, you know, and like never makes anything of him or herself, it doesn't matter because when you were 8 and that person made you feel like nothing, that's the feeling. It's not about the physical situation and what becomes of it. So this home has represented for you the almost like the essence of survival. So I understand because I do remember in your email you wrote to me and said, I feel like I'm 12 years old again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So tell me if there's anything else. So I know from what you're saying that the eating disorder got really bad in high school. And what other TMS symptoms have you dealt with since then? Because obviously there's been quite a number of years since high school.
Yeah. So I since then, you know, in college, it got really bad. And I had some scares that made me realize that I better sort out my priorities and like take care of my health. And so ever since then, I've been just kind of, I'm still very much in the throes of my eating disorder, but I'm like, I mean, I have done a lot of therapy on this and nothing really seems to help, but I'm just like, well, I just eat enough so that I'm healthy. But at the same time, I'm like obsessed with food. And that's a whole thing. But when I was 23, I had a sudden and random stomach illness or food poisoning or something. It's so strange because I've been a germaphobe since I was 10, and like I sanitize everything and I, you know, I'm very, very careful. But for some reason I had a very sudden bout of probably food poisoning because I wasn't even sick. I was only sick for like 6 or 7 hours, but it was like the most violently ill I have ever been. And that brought that phobia back with a vengeance. And so ever since then, I have been dealing with that phobia to a greater or lesser extent, and my eating disorder, and so this spring, a couple days after I got that news, I had to fly back, you know, because I'm a teacher, I had to go back to school, and I was okay for about a week. When I got on the plane a couple days after I got that news, I all of a sudden felt extremely claustrophobic, and I started like hyperventilating and freaking out. And I shoved people past to like to get up. And I went to the flight attendant and I was like, I need to get off. And like, I was like sobbing and shaking.
Oh my goodness. And I'm so sorry. I was like, that's so scary.
I know. I was like, I've never been claustrophobic before. Like, what is wrong with me? And in the back of my mind, I was like, it's probably the stress of the house. It's probably because I had to tuck this away and like say, I'm going to deal with that later because I have to go back to school. And so then I came back and like for a week, I was like, I'm going to forget about this. I'm going to ignore it because I have to do my job. I have to show up for the kids. And then all hell broke loose. And for about 2 months, the last 2 months of the school year, I had nocturnal panic attacks like I have never had before. Like I used to, you know, I might have one like every 6 months. And this was like once or twice a week, I would wake up. And for me, they show up as I'm dreaming, I'm like severely nauseous. And then I wake up feeling severely nauseous and I'm like shaking and sweating. And I never throw up, but I'm always sure that I will. And like, I call my mom and like, it's terrible. And I like, when I'm in the middle of them, I always just say like, I want to die. And I'm like, I don't know where that's coming from. Cause I know I don't actually want to die, but I would also, I'm just, yeah. And so this spring, I went on some like day trips on hikes with some friends, and I got so horribly motion sick. And I'm like, what? Like, I haven't been this motion sick since I was like 5. Like, what's wrong? Like, I had my C bands, I had my ginger, and I was like, what is going on? And like, I couldn't smell like food smells without being horribly nauseous. I was like having panic attacks in the middle of the morning and like telling my assistant, hey, excuse me for a minute, and like going to the bathroom and like taking my my medication to calm me down. And I knew in the back of my head that like this is all related to the house, but it was like I had never been so miserable in my life, even through all the other really miserable things. Like I had never been so miserable. And by the end of the semester, I was just so depressed and depleted. And that was at the beginning of June. And
so this is just this past spring.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For most of this past summer, I was either in that same mode. I was having just sudden panic attacks in the middle of nowhere, which for me start as severe nausea and thinking that I'm going to throw up, and that is just a vicious cycle. It just spirals out of control. And then finally, my mom was like, it was my mom was like, you know why this is all happening to you? And I was like, I know, it's because of the house. And she said, it's because you're not accepting that this is happening to the house. And I was really mad at her. I was like, of course I'm accepting it. Like, that's why I'm having these feelings. And she said, well, you're not talking about it. You're not talking to us about it. And I'm like, what I wanted to say is, like, you're just going to tell me that, like, it's not that bad. Which I kind of don't even believe. I'm like, how, I know that inside you are struggling too. And so, but finally one night I was in such a bad place that I said, I can't go back to my job in the fall. I said, I am so mentally unwell that I've been thinking about wanting to die. Like, I wasn't having suicide ideation. Like, I wasn't planning anything, but I was just wishing. I was like, I would just really love to die. And my mom was like, you're scaring me. Like, she was like, you need to go back on your medication. Cause I was on an SSRI for 10 years and I had worked really hard to wean myself off of it. And I thought, she's probably right, because I don't feel like I'm in a safe place right now. But from that day on, I started talking about the house every day. And so for the last month of the summer, I talked about it every day and I said the same things and I spoke the same fears. And most of my talking was crying, and it was like, it was ugly crying. Like, it was screaming and sobbing. And my mom would often be like, okay, you need to stop. You need to stop. And I was like, well, I'm sorry. Like, I'm talking about it now. But what I forget exactly how I came across your podcast. I think I was typing in something, looking for people who maybe had some idea of, like, what was going on. And I found your podcast and your work and your website at the same time that I was simultaneously realizing that every day that I was screaming and sobbing and talking about the house was a day where I was not nauseated, and where I was able to eat, and wow, where I wasn't, yes, having nocturnal panic attacks. And on the days when I either wasn't able to scream or cry, or just on the days that I didn't talk about it or, like, write it into my journal, those were the days when I have no appetite. I feel like I'm going to be sick. I'm having random and sudden, you know, panic attacks. And I was like, for the first time in my life, something like some form of, like, therapy or work or some, you know, whatever you call it, like, started to make sense, because I've had so many kinds of therapy and work and everything in my life. And, like, nothing has ever really stuck for long. And so that was kind of the beginning of me realizing that for the first time in my life, I had this direct explanation and solution to a problem. And so, a long story short, I did go back to school. And so far this fall, it's just crazy. Whenever I notice that I'm having a day where I suddenly am feeling nauseated, or I'm suddenly starting to shake, or I'm just suddenly really, really absorbed in my phobia, in my emetophobia, I'm like, oh, I haven't journaled for days. And I also haven't talked about the house in days, and it's just, it's amazing. But the more I do that, the more I realize that there's a lot more stuff that I'm just not even beginning to understand how to unravel.
Okay. So would you say what percentage, if before everything was a 10 and you were just basically maybe not having a suicidal plan, but certainly wishes that you didn't have to be here anymore. If that was a 10, what would you say your functioning is right now?
It really depends on the day. And I would say, you know, to someone looking in, they would be like, oh, you're doing great. You look like you're functioning great. How I'm actually doing is some days I'm a 7 and some days I'm a 3.
Right. Well, that's freaking great, by the way. That's like huge, huge progress.
Yeah.
So okay. So in terms of this being a real-time heal, the solution for you is going to sound incredibly simple on paper, and it will challenge you in the ways in which it challenges you in terms of, you know, how you're built. The solution is this. Your problem is 100% under the umbrella of my work. Call it TMS, call it stress illness, call it anxiety, call it panic, call it mind-body. Doesn't matter what we call it. 100%. You will 100% be well. I have no doubt. And you will meet Princess Charming and all the things are coming for you, my love. I'm certain of it. I'm listening to your energy, to your essence. And I know that's all coming for you. So know that. And also know that your nervous system has been struggling on high alert to defend you from predators since you were probably 3 or 4 years old. You know, born a highly sensitive person, wired for connection with what feels safest, which is mom and home and not being exposed to things that make you feel uncertain. And then, of course, normal life, stomach viruses and body image stuff and, you know, gender identity, sexual identity, you know, whatever it is that we have to handle as the journey of being us, it just struck you at really tender times and you're a really tender human. So consistency and patience with your nervous system is going to be your ticket to total freedom. Now, total freedom doesn't mean you're never going to have an anxious, shaky, nauseous moment, but they will be very few and far between. And when they come, you'll look at them from like over your shoulder and go, oh, hey, yeah. Oh, yeah. Not surprising you showed up today. I got you. No. We're going to handle it. You know, like it's not the same as being blindsided by something. It becomes sort of like your little sort of annoying companion that, you know, it shows up to remind you that you have work to do, and it's okay. So really the solution for you is to be consistent with your journal speak practice. Because when you said just now, if I'm having a day, I look and I realize it's been days since I journaled. Now, I want you to remember, and I want everyone out there to remember, that journal speak and all the things I teach are not a life sentence. I do not journal speak every day. If I'm going to be totally honest with you, I will go months without it, and then I'll end up doing it every day for a couple weeks because I don't want to feel shitty. I choose to feel better, but I will also resist it. But I will not need it when I'm ignoring it. I will do it when I'm needing it. And so right now for you being so young in this process and having so many years of high nervous system dysregulation, you will need to be consistent. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of interviews in this space and time because I'm starting to prepare to relaunch the podcast. And I will tell you that the people I'm hearing, these incredible success stories that I'm hearing are people who are like, nope, at the beginning, I did it every day. I was consistent. I meditated and I made this my first priority. And the beauty of it, it is only 30 minutes a day that I'm asking of you. I'm not asking you to sit for hours, you know, and to contemplate the beings of all beings. I'm saying 30 minutes 20 minutes of journal speak and 10 minutes of loving kindness meditation. That's literally it. That's all you need to do. And if you do it consistently, what's going to happen is you're going to look toward that time the way you used to look toward home. You're going to say, oh, I'm having a bit of a day, but if I can just get through it, I will sit with myself. I will sit with my journal speak. I will sit with my meditation and I will keep going. And little by slowly, my neural pathways are going to rewire, or maybe wire for the first time for safety, because you've been grasping at safety outside of yourself for your whole life.
That rings really true.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like I don't think as a little girl who was so painfully shy and sensitive with struggles with her physical body, with knowing that she's gay from a young age and maybe a not so welcoming, and we'll, I want to get to that in a minute to see how much that's been accepted. But, you know, that those kind of reachings for safety have come up very flimsy. They might not have been come up empty, because you did get comfort from your mother and your home. And, you know, it sounds like it wasn't horrible. But when we reach for safety outside of ourselves, there's only so much that can sustain it. And finding that inner safety inside didn't sound like it was very much of an option until now.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And I still feel like I'm not there yet. Like, I understand TMS and I understand journal speak, but I feel like there's this disconnect between me knowing in my head that I can take care of myself. I mean, I'm really good about taking care of myself, like, physically, but still feeling so vulnerable and feeling like I have the nervous system of a 3-year-old or even an infant. Like I feel like I just don't have it within me to comfort myself. Yeah.
And maybe right now, so I always say when people make statements like that, I want you to put it at the end of the sentence, comma, today. I don't have the resources to calm myself today, which is because today you haven't yet come down the path maybe as far as you'll need to come. But this does not mean by any stretch that you don't have that capacity. You absolutely do. Look at you. You took a job 3 states away, a girl who can't walk 5 feet from home. You did it.
Yeah, that's right? The whole story.
I'm sure it is, but whatever story led up to it, you did it.
Yeah, I still can't believe it.
Right. I mean, like, no one had a gun to your head. You did it. Uh-oh. And so I want you to remember that. I want you to remember the things you've done. You know, you were little and you were so scared and you wanted to go home. And at least on some days, your mom talked to you on the phone and you went back to class. Is that true?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You did that. Yeah. You did that with limited resources within. You did that. I promise you, honey. So did you take the flight after you panicked to the stewardess? What happened?
Yeah, actually, it was the one like really kind flight attendant I've ever met, and she was so nice. She asked if there was anyone who would be willing to switch seats with me so that I could sit in the aisle, and she came and brought me a ginger ale, and she like came and checked in on me like every 5 minutes. She was like, how are you doing, are you breathing, it'll be okay. And like, she didn't know anything that was going on, like she just knew that I was, you know, I was really not okay. And it was comforting. And like, by the time we landed, I was stable. I was like, okay, I'm okay.
All right. So once again, you were having a panic attack on a plane, which is not an uncommon thing. You sought help. You were comforted, which was a very graceful thing that happened. And you stayed on the plane. I want you to know, honey, these are huge things. Do you know how many people don't stay on the plane? Do you know how many people get a job in the next town because they can't leave their home? Like, you did big things already, and you're going to do many, many more. your life is beginning. And what's so beautiful about your story is you might have the nervous system of a three-year-old, but what's great about being three is that our whole lives still lay out ahead of us, because the greatest gift of being alive is being able to learn and grow. And you are now equipped, because you're opening yourself to this work, and you're already seeing going from a 10 to a 7 and sometimes a 3. That's a huge thing to celebrate. Huge, 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 huge. So I'm telling you, the recipe is on the box, okay? So some people, they take a box and they want to make a cake, and the cake says, I want 2 eggs and a stick of butter and whatever. And they say, yeah, you know, I really do want to make this cake, but I completely forgot to go to the store and do eggs. So I'm just going to make it without the eggs. And like, obviously no one would really do this unless they're a total idiot. But what I'm saying is that that's what people do with their healing. Okay. They see the recipe and they say, yeah, I don't mind doing this, this, and this, but I'm not going to meditate. Or I don't mind feeling my feelings, but I'm not writing them down. Or, you know, whatever the thing is. And or like, I don't mind believing that my problems are all TMS, but I'm not doing the work. Or I'm happy to do the work, but I am not going to be kind to myself. And like, I'm telling you straight up, all the ingredients are on the box. And you can make a cake without eggs. But it's probably going to look more like brownies. And I also don't know if it's going to even be good. And I know nothing about baking, so everyone out there is like, that's not how it would be. But I'm just making a point. And so all I want to say to you is just like, here's the recipe. Know from my heart that this is what is going on with you. Give me that 30 minutes a day just for the near term. Let's start with a 28-day challenge. Just start letting your body be your proof. Because what happens when you start letting your body be your proof is you start showing up for yourself. You're getting less panic attacks, and then less even more. And you're like, oh. And then your nervous system hears that and says, oh. And that's when it really starts to be in your rearview mirror. So that's the second thing. And the third thing is ample, ample, ample patience and kindness for yourself. Patience and kindness for being a grown woman who still misses her baby home and is sad about that. Patience and kindness for the three-year-old nervous system, for the fact that you were, you know, yelling at your sister and you shouldn't have been, all the things that you may have judged yourself on unconsciously or consciously. Just bathe yourself in self-compassion, because we're just human beings doing our best. We're trying so hard with what we were given at birth. And, you know, you said your sister was really different than you. And I have 3 children that are all remarkably different from each other. And there's one thing I've learned about being a parent. Nobody should mess with that whole like nature nurture thing. It is freaking both, because anyone who's had more than one child knows it is not just enough to raise them in the same household. They are totally different. You know, we're born with what we're born with, and we have to work with that.
Yeah. That's true. And I sometimes feel like I do a really good job of giving myself self-compassion and forgiveness and grace, and sometimes I catch myself kind of realizing that maybe I don't do a very good job of that. Like, I'm kind of hard on myself. Like I don't celebrate my, like what you were saying about the plane, like I don't celebrate my wins. I'm just like, I just focus on like, oh, you know this person wouldn't have done that. And, you know, and I still sometimes go back to like, well, you know, my sister has never had a panic attack on a plane. And yeah, like I forget the self-compassion part.
And I want you to think about that whole nature nurture thing I just said to you, because your sister, and this is not honestly good or bad for her, but your sister does not have the same ingredients in her that you do. It's just certain things will come easier to her and certain things will come easier to you. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah. She's doing so well about the house. I mean, I feel like she has like a really normal response. She's like, yes, I'm sad, but like, I also moved on and I'm, you know, it's no longer my home. And so, yeah, And I just, I don't know how to get there. Like sometimes I'm afraid that I'm never going to be okay. Like I'm always going to be, there's always going to be this dark cloud hanging over me. Cause like even on the days where I'm not panicking, even on the days when, you know, I've done the work and I feel stable, I have this deep, deep sorrow that feels bigger and older than anything that has even come from me. It's like I'm channeling, I don't know how to describe it, but I just, even on my best days, you know, since April, I feel like I've had this like dark cloud hanging over my head, and there's just, I can't get out from under it.
And I think that that also has to do with the fact that you have just kind of started understanding this work. I don't think you have an endless dark cloud. That it's not as bad as you think. Just and you have to just trust me, because I've watched so many people walk through this, and what you just said is such a normal thing that I hear. Just because it feels like there's a lot. It feels like there's a lot to get to, and it can feel really overwhelming. Now you did, I have a couple, first of all, I don't want to forget about a couple of my questions. How's it going with your parents and the gay thing? Are you cool with them? Are they accepting of you?
I really am. Right before I left for this job, I accidentally came out to them. It was a really bad situation. I was on a dating app, but they didn't know it, and I was scammed thousands of dollars. And my mom was out of town, and I was home alone when I found that out. And I was like, just, I called her just sobbing and freaking out. And she came home like immediately, like early the next morning. And she said, "What is going on?" She said, "I know there is something going on. You're not telling me something." And she kind of like got it out of me. And I was like, "I'm not really ready to tell you," but like, she's also known like most of my life, like at least as long as I have. So it was more just me saying, like, it wasn't me coming out to her. It was like, just me officially saying like, yes, I am gay. And, so that was interesting. The first couple of weeks were rough. Every day she was like, "Are you sure? Are you sure? Because what about this? And, you know, you've never tried this." And like, what? And I was like, I have been rock solid sure since I was 14. And I was like, you know, it's kind of hurtful and frustrating when you keep asking me, "Are you sure?" And I did the whole, I was like, "Well, are you sure that you're straight? Like, right. how did you know? Are you really sure?" And over the past couple of years, I feel like my parents, and especially my mom, because I think the whole time my dad was a little more like, they have slightly different beliefs and political beliefs and religious beliefs and things. So I've just watched my mom go through this incredible transformation from like, "I don't know if I can deal with this, and I'm certainly never going to tell anyone outside of our immediate family," to tell. I mean, the other day we were on the phone and she said something like, "You know what they say, you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your princess."
Oh, sweet.
And I see how she's trying, because she, like, because she loves me, and because she sees that she doesn't fully understand it, but she really wants to. And that is so meaningful to me. And she, I mean, even for a while, like, she didn't want to tell relatives, and I, like, I was kind of like offended by that. I was like, "So you're basically like ashamed of me." And she was like, "No," she said, "I actually am so protective of you that I know that we have certain family members that I would not like their response to me telling them, and I would be so angry with them that I would never want to speak to them again, and I'm just trying to figure out what to do about that. So it's been a journey for both of us. But at this point, I would say, you know, I have more work to do than she does, because I, you know, I was closeted for 29 years.
Right.
Not really. I didn't know that whole time. I guess 15 years. And I think that did a lot of subconscious damage to me, like to feel like I was unsafe, that like every, you know, all like the art, like I consider myself above and beyond all other jobs I've ever had, a writer. And I've written a lot of novels and screenplays and poetry that have never seen the light of day, because I was like, well, I can never share these with the world, because I can never come out, because if I did, my parents would be so angry, and they would, you know, they might disown me, or they might like send me out, you know, and like
away from your home.
Yeah. So at this point, they're pretty cool. Like I would say maybe about a year ago, my mom started saying, instead of just saying like, you know, something about me like getting married one day, like instead of just saying when you and your person, like since she started saying when you and your wife, and I was like, you know, like I see the transformation in her. And so now I'm trying to figure out how to undo a lot of that like religious trauma within me, because I did go to a religious college. I had a music scholarship there, and it was close to home. It was only 45 minutes from home, so that's why I went. Because I know some people are like, "Well, why did you go?" And I was like, "It's complicated." But I know I have a lot of work to do.
So you do, but the best part about it is that you know what you need to do. And I'm just going to beseech you to be patient and kind with yourself, because you're only 31. You have so much life ahead of you. It's going to be magical. It just takes time, and it's left foot, right foot, breathe. And it's knowing that feelings are not facts, and you can feel them and allow them to pass. And it's knowing that this too shall pass, always, always, good and bad, if you just sit with it and don't run from it or smack it in the face and say, don't look at me, it will pass. It's about sitting with it and just being gentle with yourself. So I wanted to ask that question about the gay situation with your parents, and I'm thrilled for you that it's safe, because the stuff about your sexual identity feels very similar to the stuff about your house, which is that you had some sort of bizarre safety in attaching your closetedness to your needing to your being connected to your parents and to your home. There was like a bizarre sort of conflicted safety that came with that, because as long as I'm closeted, I can have a good relationship with my parents. I can go home because I need to go home. And I don't want to upset you, but I definitely want to agree deeply with your mother that your pain and your suffering attached to this house is because you have not accepted that the house is going to be destroyed. And I know this because I've done tremendous studies in Buddhism and in clinging and in attachment theory and in suffering. And I know that all suffering comes from clinging of mind. And that is not to say that just knowing that is going to make it better, but knowing that will help you understand where you need to go. Because you're furious, as I would be. So it's not like you shouldn't be furious. It's unjust what's happening. And you're furious and you're terrified and you are grieving like someone who lost a loved one and it hasn't even been killed yet.
Yeah.
So you're in anticipation of that terrible grieving. Mm-hmm. And that is something that you just need to know, that acceptance comes from feeling through all of that screaming pain and fear and anxiety and sadness and coming out the other end cleansed. And you can't push that. You can't make grief any shorter than it is. But by accepting that it's going to be as long as it is, however long that is, it's a much better place of peace to walk through it.
Yeah, that's all so true. And it's funny because I think even after the documentary I made, even after all the journaling I've done, even after all the thinking and talking and crying and screaming I've done, some part of me, like, still almost, like when you said that, I felt like I still don't know that I've accepted it. Like, even though it feels like I have, I still actually don't feel like I have.
And that's okay. And knowing that is really important, because if you know it, then you can work with it.
Yeah.
All right, my dear. Well, listen, I think you're doing wonderfully. I'm so proud of you. I hope this call has helped you to identify where you're strong and where you're capable and where you're able. And just please take it from me that you have everything you need to come to complete freedom. It's just about getting up every day and freaking doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's lovely to meet you, Shannon.
You too. This has been really, really nice.
It has been really nice. And I just really look forward to hearing from you. So be in touch with me, okay? Let me know how you're doing.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks, Shannon. And thanks, everybody out there, for sharing space with us for this hour, for this real-time heal. I hope you got something out of it. I hope somewhere in your heart you could connect to Shannon's and to mine. And until next week, this has been the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast with me, Nicole Sachs. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.